Hey, Mac, when does deer season start?
Well, if you want the best deer herd possible, Lanny, you need to start right now.
Right now.
That's why we're starting our promotion. I mean, we've got a Deer Season Starts Now promotion on plantbiologic.com where you can pick up our Game Changer soybeans, our forage soybeans, and our spring protein peas. While you're there, you might as well go ahead and pick up some brassicas like our final forage and winter bowls.
Yeah, stock up for the cool season planting right now. Listeners to the GK Podcast, if you use coupon code GKPOD, you can save an additional 10% off our entire selection of warm season, cool season, and clover food plot seed. Get started today and visit plantbiologic.com for an unforgettable fall.
I am Jeff Foxworthy, and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
We're live in 3, 2, 1.
Okay, everybody, here we are. This is going to be a fun one today,
no
I can tell.
Doubt.
We're talking turkeys again.
Yeah, it's that time of year.
Yeah, looking around the room, Toxie, you look like you've been outlisted at some point.
Careful,
You're getting ready, I can tell. Slowly getting ready, Lanny. You're busy all the time. See you, but you're thinking about youth season coming up.
Yes.
Dudley, I've heard a few words come out of your mouth about you looking forward to the season.
Yeah.
Max over here plotting and planting and
planning
all the time.
Max already looking at the rain chances. How are we really going to know if it's going to rain a lot?
Just figured out why these two guys are going to be so nice to us. I said smiling and friendly and – we've got 10 more days of season before there's.
Oh, that's true.
No wonder Marcus is being so nice. I bet you Marcus would come up here in person in a couple of weeks.
Now, Marcus has got – he's got Florida.
That's true. That's true. He does.
He's got Florida.
Yeah.
He growed up in Alabama, but he's not there now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
That doesn't mean I wouldn't come up there in a couple of weeks.
Last time he was here, we let the air out of one.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. He sure did. So we'll go ahead and introduce you. We've got two great guests. I don't know what – this is just random order. I'm going to start at the bottom because I'm looking at Will and that bottom land shirt he's got on there. Dr. Will Goolsby from Auburn.
In the house.
And then above him in what looks like a rubber room.
He's got the most soundproof podcast room I've ever seen.
If that is a podcast.
It might be his jail cell. We don't know.
Oh, that's right. He's in the ward.
I get excited sometimes, guys.
I wouldn't. He's a big guy. I wouldn't want him hitting me.
Dr. Marcus Lashley.
In the house.
Yeah, I accused him of being a bouncer at a bar I used to go to, so.
I know which one
I'm
that
sure
was.
We were. Yep, I'm sure we were both there together and didn't know it way long time ago.
Well, it's good to have everybody together, and I'll kind of look to my right. Richie's been gone for the last couple of pods.
Good to have you back, Richie.
You can't hit the horns for yourself.
Yeah, no, that's
so he took a 2-week nap?
I don't know where. Well, he's been filming some
bears
television stuff.
And stuff like that. Georgia? You're in Georgia too, weren't you?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, there he is.
So, guys, turkey season is close, and we're ready to
– It's opened up.
3 days till youth season here.
Greg Briggs and Cousins, they've been sending me photos every day. Yeah, they've got their wounded veterans hunt they do every year in South Florida, and they've been knocking them dead.
Yeah. Said they weren't gobbling much, but they're having some pretty good success.
Yeah, every one of them's 100% success with all their guys. So
That's great.
It's a very cool thing. Yeah, but it gets your mind kind of in the gutter a little bit for what's coming up when you start seeing dead stuff.
So, Marcus, you said you're going Thursday. Is that right?
Well, I'm going down. I've got a bunch of tagged gobblers, and
that's kind of
doing some observing.
Observing,
not killing.
Okay,
Will's laughing. Are you observing with that three-inch magnum observation piece?
He's observing turkeys walk in front of his gun barrel.
Yeah. It's not fair when you can track right into them with the transmitter.
Yeah. I draw a line there. I agree with you.
Yeah. Well, good luck.
It is fun, though, because I get to go out there and spend a lot of time with them and watch them and try to learn from them.
You know, we had Tess in here, and that was amazing. Her perspective is so much better than most hunters because she shoots something thousands of times in her life and continues to get to watch them and how they behave and stuff, too. And same for you, what you're fixing to do.
Yeah, that inspired me some. I listened to her when she came on, and
she's great.
Really interesting.
She's yeah. great.
Same. I don't know if you guys, and we're getting off subject here, but that video test posted yesterday mm-hmm. of all the turkeys flying down into the field.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Go check it out if you hadn't.
It's beautiful.
It is.
She's a true artist.
Extreme chill bumps.
Yep.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I got chills when I watched it.
Yeah, I actually just got off the phone with Tess right before I joined the call with y'all, and we're trying to have her on here pretty soon too. Yeah, I mean, that was an awesome episode.
Excellent.
Yeah. So knowledgeable.
She really is. So Marcus, when we were trying to get our mics working, you mentioned that last night you were out darting some deer. Is that something I can ask you about?
I sure was trying to. we didn't do it successfully. So we have a project up in northern Florida, and it's in a poor productivity area. There are just a handful of deer in the area, but we're comparing survival and reproduction of populations of deer under different kinds of hunting methods. And I think it's going to be really interesting, but we were trying to capture a few more bucks because they're really difficult, especially this time of year to get your hands on and get a collar on.
Yeah.
But that's what the long-term goal of the project is, to compare an area that is hunted with dogs versus an area that's just still hunt only. And then we have another site that the FWC works on that has no hunting at all. So just, you know, evaluating different kinds of hunting and how it's influencing the populations.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah. Is a pneumatic gun? I have to ask about the gun.
It's basically air power, CO2. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. Pneumatic. Cool.
What's the range on that thing?
We can shoot comfortably out about 18 or 20 yards. Ooh. It starts, you know, you're lobbing them in if you're getting over 20 yards. We've shot some a little bit longer than that, but the deer can get, you know, it's like they jump the string. The same thing with the dart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not only lobbing it in there, but they hear it and they move. So we try deer, to keep it 15 to 18 yards or so.
Yeah, deer darting's more frustrating than bow hunting if you've never done it. I mean, you've got to be just as close, but you don't have the velocity that you have with an arrow, because obviously you're only trying to get the dart to stick in about an inch and a half. So, you know, if you get over penetration, it's a bad thing.
Yeah. And you're basically trying to hit them in the ham. If you move just a little bit further forward, you know, it's dangerous for the animal. So you got to be real careful about it.
Wow, that's interesting stuff.
It is.
Well, I want to ask y'all, before we get started, we want to ask you guys some questions about fire and predators. But today we released a podcast with Dr. Brett Collier, who we really enjoyed having him around. And we talked about, he really wanted to make this point about nest predators and nest scavengers. And he was kind of just trying to say, hey, guys, from what I'm seeing, and he said, this is kind of my fault. I started using the language nest predator in association with raccoons, but they're actually nest scavengers. And I just wanted to get y'all's thoughts on that. What are y'all experiencing?
We talked to him about that a few times, I guess now, one time on the air, and I thought it was really an interesting conversation, because it does really challenge you to take a step back and think through what's going on. And I have no doubt personally that some of the nest loss that we attribute to predation, and I put that in quotes, is probably scavenging. So in other words, you know, a coyote comes through and bumps a hen, or maybe a, you know, hunter accidentally bumps a hen or something, and then the nest gets eaten, even though it had already failed. We would attribute that to nest predation when it may have been a completely unrelated factor, you know, that caused the nest to fail. Because if the hen leaves, ultimately, you know, that nest is doomed either way. So in that case, I don't have very good data, and I haven't seen his data that he's relying on for that. Yet, but I have no doubt that some proportion of what we would call predation based on our field evidence that we use is probably some sort of abandonment followed by scavenging. That I think there has to be some proportion. What proportion, I don't know. Clearly, you know, when a hen gets killed on the nest, I mean, that's still predation. The nest failed because of the hen being predated. So it's a different type of predation. But, from my perspective, I can see where this could be an important part of that equation. I'd like to see some more data to understand what proportion of it is predation versus scavenging and how does that change in different contexts? Because I think that's important for us as managers.
Yeah, and I'll add to that. I mean, I think Marcus gave a really good explanation, but the difficulty in trying to assess this is a couple of things. One is you have to determine, you know, when the hen left the nest or when the hen was, you know, was killed by a predator or something like that, depending on, you know, what led up to the abandonment. And then two, you have to determine when the nest was scavenged in relation to that event. And even though we're getting really high frequency GPS data these days, you know, on some studies are getting it every, you know, 15, 30 minutes, something like that, depending on the settings, it still leaves, you know, a lot of wiggle room for what actually occurred between, you know, the point that was taken before that occurred and then the point that was taken after. And it could take a bit of a, you know, there's a bit of a time lag there.
Yeah. No, one thing I was going to add, there are a couple ways that you might get at that data. One, we have tinkered around with a little bit. No one has really tried to put cameras on the nest. And I mean, even a couple of decades probably. But that's one way if we could somehow monitor what's going on at the nest without influencing the hen. But the other thing is there's a new technology, and this may be some of the data that Brett has. I just haven't seen it yet. Where we have the high frequency accelerometry on the tag that they're putting on the hen, and you can get a lot of information about her behavior and what's going on at a really fine resolution. So they may be able to infer some of that, you know, that process from that kind of data.
We've had a lot of, in the last couple of days, a lot of, Taxi would probably be disappointed if he knew how long we'd been talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
If a raccoon could actually kill a hen.
Yeah,
we've been arguing about
could
that.
Could they ambush a hen? Yeah.
And then we were trying to figure out what a raccoon weighs, and Dudley figured out about 16 pounds for a big
around
for
here.
a big one. Yeah. Which, yeah. You know, yeah. that weighs
it's a little bigger than a hen.
More than a hen.
Well, that's two questions. Is it big enough to kill a hen?
Or to at least it's really get her not, to leave?
I mean, is it big enough to run her off or, you know, right. to take her on and push her, you know, that's a different question. He wouldn't need to be big enough to kill her to make a huge difference.
Yeah, just to push her off, you know.
But then if you plop a big camera right facing the nest, is that going to influence the hen and skew the results?
Well, why he said he made the comment about that. It would have to, they would have to know it didn't influence her.
Right. Mm-hmm. So just to give you some insight in that, one of the studies that tried to put cameras on it, and I think that, I can't remember the exact numbers. You'll have to forgive me, but it's probably like half or 60% of the hens stayed on the nest.
Right.
So they did cause some abandonment. But if you go and look at the paper, it was done in like the late 90s or early 2000s. Yeah. They literally had a VHF or a VHS tape recorder camera on a tripod looking down at the hen.
Right.
And they ran a wire from that over into the bushes that was hooked to like a, you know, a car battery, and they had to go change the tapes and you know, of course that caused some abandonment. Now we have trail cameras that are small. The ones that we were tinkering around, I think we've gotten it where we could do it. We just haven't really gotten the right opportunity yet. We literally had these little small cameras. We glued, like vegetation and things from the local environment to it, sort of like it was a little ghillie suit.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
We've done that.
And then we had it on a little mini tripod that was about 3 inches tall. And, you know, we can sneak in there when the hen's gone from the nest on her, you know, her excursions during the day.
Exactly. What I was thinking about, there. If you watched her long enough and when she left.
Yeah. Yeah, we can see. Yeah, we can hear.
Take you 5 minutes or less to put the camera up there, you know.
How long will they be gone off a nest typically? Is it just?
It's often an hour or more. So you can, you know, we can hear the where the hen is approximately, and when she gets far enough away, we can sneak in there and set it up and get away. We just, you know, our current project isn't focused on that, so we haven't been going and doing that. But that's been something of interest to me, is to try to observe what's going on at the nest, because, I mean, you guys have seen it. I've posted a couple of examples of this. People who have accidentally bumped a hen and then put a camera on it, not encouraging people out there to do it, but I have seen footage from some. You know, the hen comes back, and then they document all these interactions with raccoons and possums where the hen is actively defending the nest and running it off. So, you know, they seem to be able to defend it, at least from that size predator. So that does bring into question how much of what we're seeing is actually the coon pushing it off, you know, versus something else disturbing the hen and then the raccoon coming in and eating the eggs later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those videos really impressed upon me, you know, just how much a hen will fight for that nest. And it seems like, especially the further she gets on in incubation, the more she's willing to stay and try to fight to save those eggs. But to y'all's question, I actually was digging around in some raccoon food habits literature earlier today in preparation for some of the things I thought we might talk about.
Good job.
And the biggest prey items that I came across in any of that documentation, there was apparently a coon that was eating coots.
Hmm.
And there was a coon, it was documented that there was a coon that was eating cottontail rabbits.
Wow.
So they can get after some pretty big stuff. And I would just love to have the video of how that coon was able to chase down a rabbit. Like, how did that whole thing play out? Was it an ambush or
maybe
or
it ran down in a hole or something?
They're ferocious, and they've got to be, like, I know they say the pound for pound or whatever, gram for gram, the strongest thing on the planet's an ant, you know. But what did they say? If it was like the size of Bobby, could carry his truck around. But raccoons are not far from that. The destruction I've seen them just bend, tear metal, rip things apart, is especially around feeders and farm equipment and stuff and containers. Mm-hmm. It's crazy how strong they are.
Man, so
I
wouldn't, so smart.
If they could get their hands on something, I really don't put much past a great big one. You know, a 20 pounder could probably take on just about anything.
Mm. Yeah. All right, Dudley, I'm going to let you ask the first question.
Well, I want to hear about what you guys are working on.
Yeah.
That's what I want to hear about. The burning and the, you know, whether the predators like hanging out in those areas or not.
Speaking of burning,
very fascinating.
Dudley brings up a good point as we close on that whole topic and bringing up new information from somebody and all. It bears to bring in mind for everybody out there exactly what these guys and others, our favorites, have said again and again. Don't, there's 3, 5, 7, depending on where you are geographically, major impacts on nest success. There's a bunch of them. Don't think you can necessarily focus only on one and win your way back to success with it. You know, that's what they had warned. It's like, don't think that only doing a great job of trapping alone would necessarily do. There's so many other things. I mean, just, you know, we could sit here and name them right now, but just, that's why it's so important to listen to these people, make your notes and determine what's going on in your area and do what you can. It is maybe one of the simpler things to affect when you can just go buy traps, start trapping. It's kind of fun and whatever, but nothing replaces the kind of habitat you guys describe we need to try to head towards, you know, nothing. But I just had to point that out. There's so much more to it, why it's so important to listen to all of this data coming in from everyone, you know.
Well, Marcus said it when he started out. It changed as soon as I heard it. It changed the way I was thinking about it a little bit, because I do hyper focus on coons and possums, but I need to be focused on bobcats and coyotes just as
well.
Much.
I'm not the guy, but I'm going to say I would strongly guess that even the predation percentage with nest predators is going to change when you change geographies. I would bet you anything. Mm.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, so that's why, you know, the problems, the headwinds I talked about, I heard so bad about how bad Oklahoma's gotten. I mean, their issues are going to be vastly different than Marcus down in Florida, I bet you. They may be the same five major issues, but the percentage of what really is causing the headwind probably changes from geography to geography. I'm guessing.
There's no question that, you know, there's several factors that are at play, and the relative importance of those can be shifted depending on the context you're in. There's no question.
Yeah, and then the big one, we're all the big trump card is like, you know what, we did it. We raised a pile of turkeys, and then, oh my God, God forbid, you know, disease creeps in too. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole different one than we talk about. And what can we do about that? Even can we? So yeah, there's just so much. It's like when you see a grown turkey, it's just, sometimes it's like, how did they ever get there? You know,
it feels like that.
Everything's working. You have to take a moment to just appreciate the gauntlet that they just made it through just to make it to an adult. Mm-hmm. It is pretty remarkable. Every individual.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So recently I've seen that you guys have been discussing about some of the, what you guys are finding after some burning regimes and the type of these predators that are either like being in certain areas or dislike being in certain areas. Can you guys kind of explain what y'all have found there?
Yeah, I'm happy to start. I know Will has some really good insights on the same topic, but recently, well, let me back up a minute. I have said multiple times to people, and I didn't feel like it necessarily resonated with people why I might say this, but I have said something along the lines of, you know, habitat management is anti-predator management, or it is predator management, or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people hear that and they immediately think, and this is the way I was thinking until some of the recent data that we, you know, that we uncovered through our literature review. Most people inherently think, oh, if I improve nesting cover, which means just having more dense cover that allows the hen to hide from predation or predators better, you know, that would be what the mechanism is. But some of the recent evidence shows that there's another part of this equation that's probably very important, and that is not just that the hen in that circumstance example I just gave, not only can she hide herself better in some types of structure of plants and communities of plants, but also those same characteristics about the plant community tend to negatively influence habitat quality for some of the things that would predate her, like raccoons, for example. And I think one of the, well, few studies that we have uncovered looking at these types of relationships show it really well, particularly with fire and open landscapes, you know, where we have an open forest type, whether it's pine or hardwood, doesn't matter. But you have high sunlight penetration, what we are recommending people do all the time to improve nesting and brooding cover for turkeys. When you have more frequent fire in that context where you have high sunlight, you start to see a decrease in the use of many of the predators, especially the nest predators. So, for example, raccoons, there was one study that showed the use of a recently burned area, and I just mean something that was burned the same year, the use declined by more than 60% by raccoons. Mm-hmm. They've literally got a raccoon tagged. They see its home range and how it's using space, and then go into that and burn an area, and its use of that space that was burned within the last year decreases by more than 60%. So, you know, that's substantial.
Yeah.
Your daughter's been begging you to hunt since her little brother shot the big 8 last year. You've ran a fire, dissed the fields, got stuck, got unstuck, planted food plots, fertilized, and prayed for rain. You moved trees, limbed roads, even bought one of those fancy cell cameras.
So what's your excuse?
LS Tractor.
Moultrie has pioneered the game management category. Today, Moultrie is one of the best-selling brands of feeders and seeders in the world, and they continue to innovate with new technology that gamekeepers will rely on. Moultrie products are always field tested and designed for hunters by hunters, combining forward thinking, innovation with time tested practicality. Moultrie, first in feeders since 1979. All right, so guys, Moultrie is offering our listeners a 15% site-wide discount at MoultrieFeeders.com. Use code MossyOak with a capital M, MossyOak, at MoultrieFeeders.com and get that 15% discount.
I wonder if you've had, it made me think about it. I've always noticed in the last, 10 or 15 years, since they've become such an issue themselves, hogs. By my experiences, they don't like fire, and when I burn places, they're out of there, and they don't necessarily come back just right away like the raccoons even might and stuff. I mean, it seems to displace them. I don't know if it's just because they fear it so bad or whether it changes things to the point where there's not as good a food source as farmer or something, but it anything to move them out.
Barbecue. They're worried about barbecue.
Absolutely, but I think it helps for a while. I don't know how long. But it definitely helped for a while.
Well, there one of the studies talks. It was a perfect illustration of what you're describing. One of the studies, it was done across North Florida, and they had these arrays of cameras, just trail cameras, but they're in a grid and they're standardizing the effort in all these areas, trying to monitor mammals. Well, one of them they were detecting frequently was feral hogs. Across all these sites, and when they looked at the patch scale, which was basically a grid of cameras that was covering a couple hundred acres, on average across this study, they were detecting pigs in that area reliably, like 85-90% detection rate. All right, so there's a lot of pigs in this landscape they're working in. That was when there was no fire. So places that are not being burned at all, and it's all upland, open pine. In that context, in that study, at that scale, when they move to more frequent fire, so in other words, they get up to like 6-8 fires per 20 years. So you think about that's a 3-year return interval or 2.5-year return interval. The detection of pigs falls to less than 20% in the study.
I'll take it.
So substantial decline based on how frequent your fire return interval is in your return.
Yeah. And I mean, when you stop and you think about that within the context of turkey habitat needs and turkey habitat selection, it's like you're getting both benefits at the same time. You're improving how many turkeys are selecting for that area. You're potentially improving their performance in that area by giving them better food and cover, and you're removing the species that either, directly prey on them or that compete with them for food resources.
Mm-hmm. Like I need another reason to want to burn all the time, but that gets me fired up. But listen to y'all talk, it made me realize too that we know that behind the burn is attractive to turkeys for nutritional purposes, actually, if the hogs leave, I mean, I've always felt like one of the big buzz kills of hogs is depleting the nutrition for deer and turkeys, both, especially turkeys. Yeah. And so if you get a look, you knock them away a little bit better. I mean, isn't one of those top five things we would talk about be how the nutritional and the health of the hen as she goes into nesting? Her state is so important to nest success. Well, if you give her a little bit better food and get rid of the hog competition, that's a big, big plus right there.
There's a couple of papers that I recently incorporated into a talk that Marcus and I gave to some biologists and technicians in South Carolina the other week. And specifically in those papers, they did find some strong associations between hen body condition, clutch size, nest success, and even timing of nesting, showing that the hens that were in better condition tended to lay their eggs earlier in the nesting season.
Yeah, with bigger clutch sizes and higher success.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you think about it's almost like compounding interest.
Yes,
right?
Exactly
what
I was thinking. Exactly.
Exponential.
When you think about it on a landscape scale, when you're just say you're looking at an old topo map from the 60s, or you can get on your phone and rewind the time. when there was more frequent fire. You had a lot more grassy cover, and I don't think a pig would like that sun shining on their back so much. And it, you know, in my mind, they're just retreating to the drainages and the bottoms that aren't burning, along with the raccoons. I mean, they're traditionally bottomland and drainage species. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, just like a lot of plants, you know, you start burning a lot. You don't see water oaks up on top of the hill nearly as much. They retreat back to where they originally were intended.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I think that is a perfect way to describe it, Dudley, that, you know, I have worked with several scientists on this idea that excluding fire has allowed all these offsite mesic plants to kind of colonize up into the uplands.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's a problem that comes with fire suppression across the landscape. Well, the same thing happens with the wildlife species, exactly what you just said. And I think we have shown with a collection of studies now, it's very strong data. When we have relatively frequent, and in the study I just mentioned earlier, that just means at least a 5-year return interval, or more frequent than that's better. When we create those dry, you know, frequently burned uplands, all of those species, to include, you know, the hogs, the gray fox, raccoon, possum, armadillo, all of them were relegated to the bottom ones, you know, in that frequent fire system. And, you know, it was basically across the board. They were all being detected over 70% of the time when it wasn't being burned compared. And this was replicated across many sites. Compared to if they're on a 2-year return interval, they're all being detected less than 10% of the time. You know, I mean, that we're completely transforming the landscape of predation for something like a turkey that enjoys the plant community structure that comes with open forest conditions and frequent fire.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think like a pig or a raccoon that's covered in fur. I don't know if I would want to be out on that, and I'm dark. I wouldn't want to be out on that more open landscape with the sun beating on my back all day.
Mm-hmm.
They just seem like they really would prefer to be lower in elevation.
Is that called coon empathy?
I don't want to be out there either.
Hog empathy?
Yeah.
So I think there's really two important points here. And the one that probably everybody's thinking about is the implications of this for their property, right? So we want to, you know, burn a greater percentage of our uplands than we're burning if we're not, you know, if we don't have it all on a fire rotation. We want to make sure that we're burning frequently enough to discourage predator use. But also I encourage people to think about, this is a problem that is occurring at the scale of the entire region, right? So we have made conditions potentially by, you know, we know over the last several decades that longer than that even, that the amount of the landscape that is burned on a regular basis has declined. So at that region-wide scale, we're making things better for turkey predators and worse for turkeys at the same time.
Yeah, there's a really cool study. It was written by Hanberry and others, and I think it was published in 2020 maybe, and they produced a map of the essentially everything from the prairie east. And virtually all of it historically mapped as some type of open forest with frequent fire. I'm talking about from Canada to, you know, central Florida over to the prairie line, all of it mapped, just about all of it. There's some pockets like the Mississippi Alluvial Valley and a couple of places up in the northern reaches that were closed forests, you know, that were protected. But most of it was open forest with frequent fire. And that, I mean, that almost doesn't even exist now, at least at scale across that landscape. So I definitely think this is a landscape issue. Another thing I might add to that, one of the recent publications from Mike Chamberlain's group showed this. I think there are a couple of really interesting anecdotes in their paper where they had a whole bunch of sites across the Southeast, and they reported nesting success across all these sites. And they had two sites within that study One was in South Carolina, the Webb WMA complex. Another one was in Georgia. Do you remember the name of that one?
Silver Lake.
That's it. Both of those are managed principally. I think Silver Lake's actually a quail focal area, but both of them are primarily open with frequent fire. Mm-hmm. And the nesting success for turkeys, as they measured it in that study, was 47% on both of those areas.
Wow.
On average.
That's a big number.
That is absolutely outstanding.
Yes.
Well, what's really interesting about that number to me is it seems like over the past few months or so, it keeps coming up again, because I think last time we were on with y'all, we may have talked about some of the findings that Craig Harper had in Tennessee relative to habitat and nest success. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you look at the hens that specifically nested in early successional vegetation types, you know, it, assuming that they weren't mowed, because they had a lot of nests that ended up getting mowed, you know, by a bush 100%. Hog in that study. Yeah. It added up to about that same number, about high 40s, about 50%. So I'm starting to wonder, is that what we can expect in terms of nest success on areas that have really well-managed habitat? I'm not sure yet. This is all anecdotal, but it is interesting.
I will say there are very few observations of nesting success being higher than that. Mm-hmm. And those, can't think of any that have a long-term and really high sample size that are higher than that.
You can make the point right now that that's your best chance, regardless of other data you may be missing to make the call.
Right.
You can say that definitively right now. It's your best chance to achieve that.
Absolutely. You know,
already. So all the more reason to head that way.
If we were pulling off 40-something percent nesting success across the range of turkeys, we don't have a productivity problem anymore.
No.
It's just like that. That is substantial. And, you know, that was the point. I think that, you know, we would love to get that to 70, but I don't know if we can.
No.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, man, that 40 right 50% there,
is absolutely outstanding.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
So is it safe to assume that, you know, these areas that have 47% success, that's great. They've been burning and doing these habitat manipulations long enough to where it actually changes the landscape. You know, a lot of us, I'm kind of in the same boat. I've only been burning about 10 or 15 years, but most places I've only had the chance to get in there and burn it three or four times. Mm-hmm. Now, the fire is great, but until you've been doing it for a number of years and it actually starts changing the landscape, I think that's where we're going to start seeing considerable results like this 47% you're talking about.
That's amazing. So that leads me to a question also when you talked about three-year intervals, two-year intervals, and I've heard, you know, a lot of the disseminated knowledge we get is based on growing pine trees. You know, mm-hmm. which is, you know, kind of the epicenter of burning. So let's just take, for example, I think of some of the places that I have or I manage or whatever. And it's like kind of openish prairie scattered stuff. But then, you know, it's kind of that, you know, Demopolis outcrop type of stuff woven into some pretty good soil. But it's going to be open every year. I have no concern over damaging any timber to burn it every year. Any reason, and the fuel comes back just the same, but I can see it evolving. I've been burning every year. Should I back off of that if I can burn every year? And I'm not worried. It's no issues as far as timber.
Both of us talk about this all the time, but I mean, my only concern with burning every year would be that the grass density would get too high for turkey poults to be able to move through it.
Right.
But if you've still got bare ground up underneath and you've got plenty of space between those clumps of grass, and there's also very importantly still, you know, a good representation of forbs that are producing seeds and attracting insects that those poults can feed on, I think you're in good shape.
You know, I don't have all the species. I can think of some of them, but it's like the more we burn, the more wildflowers we see in the summer, which I think that's a pretty good sign.
Absolutely is. Well, the other, also, Tuxie, I have a lot of experience in that part of the world, as you know, and have family land there. You know, in that system, I'm thinking about a lot of those the open uplands as poult rearing.
Right. Areas. Uh-huh. Yes.
And if you have a propensity of forbs in that community, which it sounds like you do, mm-hmm. then you're probably really high productivity, especially in that poult rearing stage. And then you probably have little fingers of wetlands, it's a little more dense, where that fire interacts with water. And I suspect a lot of your nesting is probably occurring in that ecotone, mm-hmm. associated with that little patches of woods.
Yeah, what I've liked about listening to all of you is that it's kind of clumpy when you're done. Mm-hmm. And even on into the nesting season, there's a lot of stuff, you take it from really brushy or grassy, it's just clean as a park, but it's not like big, wide expanse of that. It's real clumpy. So I feel like
we've
got the combination of the nesting and the poult rearing both there by burning it. So far, it keeps evolving to what I like better. Now, I don't know that I'm not causing some kind of damage burning every year, but I don't know. It's very clean and looks very poult rearing to me through the season, at least.
Well, do you have a lot of turkeys on it? You don't have to disclose the location.
Yeah, I would say it's heading in the right direction, yes. Well, that's good. It's definitely, and I'll say for everybody.
Proof's in the pudding, right?
Just about everywhere we burn aggressively has gotten better. But I think a lot of people have gotten better, so I can't say that's the only reason. But definitely it appears to have helped. Definitely.
Yeah. And if I can circle back for a second to something, Dudley, you mentioned earlier, as far as the number of burns that you get on it so that you're, really starting to change the landscape. I don't think it's necessarily the total number of burns that is driving the results over those management areas. I think once you get a few rotations in a desired frequency, most of the plant community that you're going to see is going to be there, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to get a very similar response going forward after a few rotations, as long as you stay consistent. But the thing that those management areas have going for them that we may not always on the tracks that we hunt is that they're larger, right? So you've got a larger scale over which you've been able to implement that habitat, which obviously confers an advantage.
Yeah, one thing I might add, sunlight is the ultimate factor here that's important. If you're burning underneath a closed canopy of woods, it's going to take you a long time, and you're going to have to kill some trees with fire before you get the desirable association of plants that you're looking for. But if you pair it with some sort of thinning operation or forced stand improvement where you're breaking that canopy and allowing sunlight to penetrate, I agree with Will. You can get to what you're looking for fairly quickly.
Have you heard about the LS Gamekeeper tractor giveaway? That's right, we're handing over one of our Gamekeeper used LS tractors, and believe us, the team isn't thrilled about saying goodbye. This powerhouse comes equipped with a front loader, belly mower, backhoe, and tiller, making it the ultimate camp tractor with unmatched versatility. It comes with a certified pre-used warranty straight from LS, and the Gamekeeper's crew has given it their stamp of approval. Don't miss out. Head over to mossyoakgamekeepers.com to discover all the ways you can throw your hat in the ring.
Hey guys, Dudley from Gamekeepers here. I want to tell you about the all-new Gunner Dog Bowl. It's designed for home and built for travel. It's customizable, leak-resistant, light on weight, solid on durability, and rust-proof. Like other Gunner products, they're made in Nashville and designed for everywhere.
I'll add one thing. We also parked the bush hog better in the last, say, 10 years. And it was actually, I'm kind of a native plant wildflower nut kind of anyway, raised by my mom who loves them. And so I was just thinking, let them go to seed before we do anything. So we actually just stayed on a lot of those places completely off of cutting any brush at all. And the more I did that and then burn aggressively, the more I began to see more and more of the wildflowers too. I guess you're getting stuff that wants to be scarified and likes fire, but you're letting it go ahead and mature and go to seed too. So I don't know if the combination has been a help for me or not, but I really like the way the land looks. I'll say that. And we certainly are trending right.
Well, not mowing during nesting and brooding is probably a good idea, especially, the study from Tennessee.
Yes.
12% of the nests were in a place that could be mowed were lost to mowing.
Yeah.
Like that's something we can easily not do. Just don't mow during nesting
at all.
Yes. Right. Yeah. So, yes. But the other thing that I wanted to point out about that study is when they added the early succession and shrubland together, what they considered nesting and brooding cover on the landscape, they estimated it was 7% of the area. You know, that's showing you at the landscape scale that those, you know, nesting and brooding cover, and particularly brooding cover, is dramatically limited. And that's been consistent across multiple studies now.
Wow.
Those things, I don't know what percentage of the landscape needs to be it, but I'm pretty confident it needs to be more than 7%.
Yeah.
And half the hens nested in that 7%.
Yeah, almost half.
They were showing strong selection for it.
Wow.
I mean, you know, just drive around and look, and it's, you really don't see a lot of good nesting and brooding cover on the landscape.
Yeah. Nesting is a little more common, but man, it's still not common.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mac, did you have a question?
I've got a lot of questions, yeah. But one that I wanted to talk about, I mean, just because, I mean, it is getting to be turkey hunting season. It is down in Florida right now. So what ignites the securing a breeding opportunity? Because, I mean, you think I think of it like in a deer rut scenario, and that's necessarily not the same with turkeys. So, I mean, could a hen get impregnated by a longbeard in August in Mississippi? Or what's that cycle? How does that work?
That's a good question.
Well, you're the physiologist here.
So. Well, yeah. Yeah.
You're doing all the
if I'm the physiologist, we're in trouble. But I'll take a stab at this. I mean, you know, one of the things that we really don't have good data on is when most of the copulation occurs in turkeys, the actual, you know, the breeding event. And what complicates that, I mean, we have great data on when they start nest and when they start incubating those nests. But the complexity in all this is that hens can store sperm. So just because we know when they laid an egg, we don't know when that fertilization event actually occurred. So not only that, but we don't know when the sperm that fertilized that egg was implanted into that hen's oviduct either, because of that sperm storage issue. And to be clear on that, it was long thought, and what I was originally taught is that hens could store sperm for about up to a month. But Marcus and I just had a conversation with an animal behaviorist on our podcast. I think we were talking a little bit with y'all about that conversation before we started recording. And he said that in domestic turkeys, it's been documented that they can store sperm up to 5 months. Yeah. Wow. Now, a hen that was bred 5 months before she lays those eggs, some of those eggs are going to be infertile. Right. We, you know, no doubt. But it is possible for fertilization to still occur. So it's difficult to determine when a lot of that fertilization is actually occurring and when the copulation event that led to that actually occurred. And that throws a lot of uncertainty in the mixture.
So I've talked about this just last week.
Yeah, I was going to reference that.
When we first had turkeys brought in here, we got them on February 15th and no gobblers. And
no roosters.
Yeah. We lost two, so we only had eight. So we know for a fact 6 out of those 8 raised. Mm-hmm. And we got them on February 15th. And we got 2 Jakes on May 2nd. And of course, back then, the legendary Dr. Hurst was our confidant over here at Mississippi State. And Daddy asked him and said, and I've said this before, so everybody's heard it already, but he's like, he was just astounded and ecstatic. It's just, I can't believe this. He said, those Jakes, I can't believe that. He said, no, sir, those Jakes did not breed those hens. They were already bred when you got them. That is the only way that happened. Mm-hmm. So that was February 15th, and that came from the Mississippi River. Maybe things get cranked up early over there or what, but it just shows you how early it probably can start and work,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I mean, Tess was talking on y'all's podcast the other week about seeing a lot of breeding going on about this time of year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's hard to say for sure.
Yeah. And Will, do you remember? I can't remember specifically, but there was a state report from the state agency in Texas that was looking at some of this. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was like a 2-month gap between a lot of the observed copulation and the hen nesting, right? Wasn't it something?
Yeah, like I don't remember the specifics of that one.
Yeah, I need to go back and look at it, but it is kind of interesting. You know, that really throws a loop into stuff.
Yeah.
And it makes it really hard to understand what you're seeing.
It's almost too. I know y'all can watch things now with modern electronics and things have progressed so much, and you can monitor things better. But even my whole life, turkey hunting and being around them, it's such a mysterious thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, I never see any of these turkeys breeding. I've been fooling with them every day. I never see it, yet they're all bred. You know, that's it's almost a mysterious thing. And sometimes you'll go through a day of subsequent hunts where maybe you see it a couple times, but it's not the most common thing to witness, honestly.
Do you remember the first time you ever saw it?
Yeah.
I mean, and like you're thinking, what am I seeing? I was
old enough to know by the time I saw that.
Yeah.
I didn't have to ask Daddy.
What they doing, Daddy?
Daddy's beating her. What's going on?
Why won't he get off of her?
It is pretty
violent sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. So you think
it's pretty remarkable to think about how many people spend, I mean, basically their entire life in the spring looking at turkeys as much as possible, and it is fairly rare to see it.
Yeah, it is.
So there could be a difference, and I've always thought, you know, peak breeding would be around peak gobbling, but it might not be that way.
I've come to believe it's more like I think Dr. Chamberlain turned my head around more than anybody. I think it's more driven by, if you see it a lot, it's because you're around a certain gobbler who's promiscuous more than, you know, he's a real super breeder guy instead of necessarily just the average group. I don't know. It just seems like run into certain situations if you're fooling with turkeys for a few days, and certain turkeys just seem to be more, you know, you see it more.
Well, also on that note, you know, I don't really turkey hunt like I deer hunt now. So when I deer hunt and I see a buck, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't look at him for too long before I put him on the ground.
Yep.
And nowadays, a lot more of us are passing up bucks, but we're getting to witness the show. Yep. We were talking about this with Tess Jolly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
With turkeys, yeah, I mean, we love the show, but let's face it, a lot of us pull the trigger before we have a chance to see any of that happen. So
I've got one more question, and it's got to do with, I guess, the laying process. So what would be a good number, you would say, in a clutch? 8? I mean, would 8 be a fair average or less than 8?
Around 10.
Okay, so 10.
Yeah, 10 is a typical average that we see oftentimes for Easterns.
So if they're laying 10 eggs, so each day she'll go and lay an egg. And then after that, I guess, 10th day, potentially, she could sit on that nest for 28 days, right?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, give or take a few days.
So are all the hens, or majority of the hens, laying during that same 8 to 10 days?
Go ahead. I tried to give you a break to answer if you wanted to.
Yeah, I think the simple answer to that is it's just a distribution. You know, it's a normal distribution. It's a bell curve. And so, you know, just by default, you take the average and 50% of the hens, or take the median rather, and 50% of the hens are going to nest before that and 50% after. You know, so if you just quantify that central tendency, it may be around a certain date, but there are certainly some that are way before and certainly some that are way after. And that's even if you just look at first attempts, it can be pretty spread out.
Yeah. Subsequent attempts, does it go down 20%? 40%. I mean, if there was 10 on average on a second clutch, what does it come cut down to? I know it's got to be less.
The Furminator is the industry's most versatile piece of food plot equipment, allowing plotters to do every step of the process, working the soil, adding seed and soil supplements, and compacting. From start to finish, with a single implement, it's hassle-free by design. Set it for the seed size and simply drive the tractor, and the Furminator does the rest. Check it out at theferminator.com.
Nosler is known for their bullets, and now they're making suppressors. Nosler suppressors are made for hunting. Adding a Nosler suppressor to your rifle will make you a quieter, more accurate, and more effective hunter. Protect your hearing and disturb less game with a Nosler suppressor. The time to hunt quiet is now. Learn more at Nosler.com.
Oh, I'm not sure about that. Are you, Marcus? I've never looked at clutch size by attempt.
It's definitely lower, but I don't recall exactly.
That probably, how you know, that lower. That goes to the point of how if she's in great nutritional health,
mm-hmm.
probably mm-hmm. the well, better health she's in, she's got a better chance to have not only a few more on the second one, yeah. but healthier. Well, that's ones one too. Of
the
yeah.
One of the things they showed in the study Will mentioned earlier is that hens that were in better body condition laid a larger clutch and were more successful up front. But
right.
I think the clear thing that happens isn't necessarily – well, the clutch size is a little bit smaller on the subsequent nest attempts, but the success of that nesting attempt drops precipitously also.
Yeah, I think that's what we talked to someone the other day, that having them and having them all in good health and everything is kind of synchronized typically will make for a better hatch, and then they're all spread out over a couple of months, you know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that first attempt has to be very taxing. You know, they lay an egg every day, and then when they're sitting on the nest, they're not moving around, they're not exercising, they're not eating, they're not drinking.
Yeah. But you would think that if they get busted at the very end of that cycle, it's really, really hard on them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I hate to compare my chickens again, but here we go. I mean, the broody hen that sits on the eggs, you know, they lose a lot of weight. I mean, they're literally sitting on that thing all day, every day, and they don't get up much. Yeah. So that's got to be very taxing on their body.
So an extreme example of this that paints a real clear picture for, you know, the demand that nesting places on a hen's body is that, you know, we go to arid environments like South Texas and we see in drought years, there's many hens that don't even attempt to nest. Right. I mean, you may see a year that no hens that you have, they'll say you have 20 or 30 tagged and none of them may even try to attempt to nest.
They're just trying to survive.
Right.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. They're trying to maintain, you know, an animal kind of makes decisions about lifetime fitness, right? And how many young that they produce over their entire life. And we see this oftentimes in females, not just in birds, but in mammals as well. Well, where they will forego, you know, having young in a given year during bad conditions, you know, whatever that might entail, or, you know, they may not provide as much care for any young that they do have when conditions are bad or she's in poor body condition or whatever, because she's thinking about not just that year's offspring, but in her entire lifetime's worth of offspring. And with turkeys, you know, being a relatively long lived species, you know, as far as most birds go, that's definitely something that they have to factor into their quote decision-making process.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing about the Texas situation is when the rains come, you know, when it rains, the whole place turns into nesting and brooding cover, and then they just explode.
Yeah, that's right. It's like it's like it rains poults from the sky when they have a west wind.
We were talking to Brett Collier about it, and what did he say, Will? He said something like the poults just like
they just come out of the ground.
Yeah,
they just emerge out of it.
Well, not only
I think what's happened is all those plants are emerging, and man, that's really good stuff for nesting and brooding.
And they've got food. I got to thinking before too, having been out there a lot, that in a lot of those places, you said, now you enlighten me, the hens won't even try to nest. But even if they were to hatch some and they can't get to water. I mean, in some places there's no water. Those tanks might be the only place in a super drought, and they can't get up to get water from a tank probably.
Yeah. Nah, that's a good point.
In case of maybe a few places it leaks out or something, but you know, the limited supply of water, they die of thirst. Man, that breaks my heart thinking about that.
The other thing without that canopy of forbs, I mean, the exposure to the elements is going to kill them fast. Yeah. But, you know, they can't deal with that heat.
So have you guys been watching that, the Weather Channel, and there was a terrible fire that went through the northern part of Texas.
Still going right now?
Yeah. I mean, it's just devastating the habitat. So what's happening with those turkeys out there and that ground, do they just fly off and then eventually come back? I mean, it's such a giant fire.
Yeah, million and something. Yeah, like
where, yeah. What? How big was it?
Million plus. I think. Yeah.
Which
Panhandle, what Amarillo area, maybe up that way.
Yeah. I haven't seen any. Have you seen any studies on looking at turkeys?
No, I haven't. I don't know. It seems like, you know, with all the turkeys we've had tagged over the past few decades, that there would have been at least one instance of that occurring where some tag turkeys were, but I'm not sure.
So how do they behave? How do they behave in like a prescribed fire burn that's pretty significant? Do they just fly over to the backside of it and go right on about their business, or how does that disturb them? Y'all would know that probably.
Oh yeah. And we have quite a bit of data. I've collected a lot of it myself. With prescribed burning, even at relatively large scales, turkey attraction to that burned area is really quick. So basically right after the fire, you know, there's a magnet effect on turkeys. In terms of during the event, they're obviously going to be displaced somewhat to it, but even in North Carolina, when I was working on Fort Bragg, they were burning at the time at really large spatial scales, you know, 1,000-acre units even, and turkeys were right back in that right after it happened.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if in some of those bigger fires, they're, you know, the flame front gets to them and they're just hopping over that and going in the black and starting to feed while the fire's still burning across.
That's exactly
the unit.
What I was thinking.
Yeah, because we were watching that. My wife, Diane, was like, oh my gosh, what happens to all the deer and the turkeys? You know, she loves turkeys too. And I was like, I really don't worry about turkeys for that. They're going to fly away from whatever and survive. Yeah.
They're going to be okay. And they'll be right behind the fire.
But you know, those,
I don't know if you guys saw. I posted a video that a guy sent to me, or actually Will and I posted. I guess it was in a reel that we posted on Instagram. But he sent me a video clip where they were conducting a prescribed fire, and you could see the smoke on his trail cam. And there's gobblers all in the forefront strutting while the smoke is going through from the prescribed fire in the back.
Yeah.
You know, they obviously weren't that worried about it.
Oh, I guarantee you where you frequently burn, there's no question they'll learn. I guarantee that if they've lived long enough, they know what's up.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's important for folks to think about is, you know, turkeys were responding to fire long before, you know, we were lighting prescribed fires or we were getting prescribed burn manager certifications, you know. So, you know, there was one study, you know, in all sorts of natural disasters were key, including wildfire, in creating the habitat conditions that they require. And I know of one anecdote from a study that, well, it's not an anecdote, they have data to back it up, but it was several years ago in a tornado, or not a tornado, but a hurricane actually came through their study area, knocked down a bunch of trees, created a lot of good nesting cover. And the next year, hens were preferentially nesting in the area where the hurricane had impacted the most. Wow. So that natural disaster had essentially created those conditions. And I imagine it's probably similar with wildfire.
Yeah, I suspect. So one thing I was going to add, I handle lots of fire related research as a reviewer or an editor. And one thing that has been really interesting about some of the information about wildfires is thinking about how fire behavior changes across a huge landscape, you know, that 1,000,000 acres, you not only have an enormous variation in the flammability of the landscape because you have streams and different vegetation types within it, but also the fire is often burning through the night and during the day. And you kind of have this really extreme change in fire behavior associated with that. You end up often with this mosaic of vegetation, much like what we're recommending, even after some of those large events where the fire was burning real hot for a while and then night fell and the fire behavior kind of, failed to creep, and then it kind of creeps around and then you have some natural fire breaks, you know, with the stream or something. So you have an unburned patch and, you know, it starts to make this messy landscape like what we're often recommending people try to do, when there's those different variations in the vegetation. It's really different from a dry system that has accumulated a lot of fuel. You know, you don't necessarily get that mosaic in some of those.
Yeah, I might recommend. Certainly, you might build some in if you need to on that.
Right. Yeah.
What do we, from day one?
You certainly could with a prescribed fire, yeah.
Yes. Diversity, diversity, diversity.
Yeah, sadly, I'm afraid the panhandle experience a wildfire. Oof. You know, they're burning through that duff layer. They're causing the soils to become hydrophobic, where it's harder for them to soak in moisture. Yeah. It can be kind of a sensitive subject. You know, we're talking about people's lives are impacted.
Absolutely.
Here. But
yeah, there's no question that they can be catastrophic, and particularly in dry systems that have accumulated a lot of fuel, they can definitely be catastrophic to people and wildlife. No question.
Mm. Wow. Mac, did we answer all your questions?
I mean, I've got more if you want me to keep firing away.
One more time, I think it's worth mentioning now that Dudley brought that up, is that there is also a quote-unquote mosaic of training to go get. The major universities, I'm sure. What does Florida do it? Once, twice a year? I know State does it once or twice a year, but – you know, I guess they could go to one of y'all's sites, but people should pay attention to that. And if the more, you know, I can sure, David Hawley sent me a map a couple of weeks ago, Marcus, and you should have seen the state of Alabama. You know, those little icons and flames.
He sent that to me too.
Yeah, yep. You couldn't find a part of the entire state that wasn't in flames. And so this lets me know people are listening to what we're saying and other people too. But I think it'd be incumbent upon everybody out there to try to get just one day, right?
Yeah. Some of the states are, yeah.
Yeah. Look up where you can go get certified and learn all the nuances of burning, especially the safety part. I would recommend that to anybody who has an interest in it. We've talked about it before, but you can speak to that real quick for people because it's really important.
Well, I think, you know, most anywhere you're at, there's going to be opportunities to get a prescribed fire manager training. And I highly encourage people to take advantage of that. It's usually the state forestry agency that hosts that. There's also learn and burn opportunities really commonly. There's prescribed burn associations popping up everywhere where landowners are coming together to help each other burn and get experience and share resources. Also, I was leading a group of researchers that we put together a comprehensive online program. This doesn't get you certified, but it gets you really knowledgeable about a lot of things you need to be thinking about with prescribed fire. And that's freely available to anybody who wants it. Just go look in my link tree on social media. You know, you have many resources available to you to get knowledgeable so that you can use fire safely to accomplish your objectives.
So you're more likely to get the results you want, selfishly or not. You're more likely to not make a mistake and ever do anybody harm or get on your whatever. And then, God forbid, something does happen. You've got better liability coverage, you know, indemnification from that because you did go to the trouble to get trained. Yep. And if you did all your homework, that's the best you can do. I mean, it's really hard to mess up if you know what you're doing and you just have the discipline to not do it unless your conditions are perfect, you know?
Yeah, sir. That's a really good point, Toxie. You know, Alabama in particular is right to burn state. If you're a certified prescribed burn manager, it reduces the liability. You know, as long as you follow, you know, you're certified and you follow everything else required, you know, a burn permit and all those sorts of things. And there are many other southeastern states that have similar policies. So not only will it help you better achieve your objectives, but it also limits your liability and makes you more effective as a practitioner at the same time.
Have any of y'all ever had a fire and it got out of control and you had to call and get some help from like the Forestry Commission?
I've had them show up. I've never.
Yeah, you know, I will say that, Dudley. It is funny though. No, never. And I've burned. I'm not going. It sounds like I'm bragging if I talk about me because I've burned in my life, but it's a big number, and I've never had anything get away at all. But quite a few times I've had like the local county fire department show up
every time,
even though never once in my life have I burned without a permit and everything else. And they've got that. I don't know why they don't just call the forestry commission and find out, but the neighbors
sometimes
will call.
They'll even show up when you call them and let them know you're doing it.
That's right. Yeah. They will. Exactly. So I've had that happen a lot and even get calls in the middle of the night about it, you know, but a neighbor's called and thinks something's on fire and they don't bother to check. They just run out there. And I hate, caused a problem, but everything was safe. Never had an issue.
I think a lot of the local fire departments, you know, they have to respond if somebody calls.
Maybe that's the case. Yeah.
Well, it's better safe than not for them.
Yeah, and I'll typically, in an area that I'm burning, I mean, even if it's just a little local volunteer fire department, I'll try to get their number and call them and give them a heads up about what time we plan to light and what time we plan to be done. And that usually goes a long way towards preventing any of those issues.
A lot of those folks may have had, you know, a family function that night and they have to respond. So good point, Will. Just, you know, let your neighbors know, let the local, the volunteer fire department know.
I feel bad now. I just assumed when you got your permit, it covered it, but.
Yeah, spread the word.
Yep.
What about you, Marcus? You got kind of quiet on me there. You didn't really answer my question.
I never have had an issue.
Bobby,
he just calls it it bonus acres.
Yeah. Well, we've had fires get across the line, but never had anything where we needed help. So you know, we were able to contain it.
Right. So and, is there a service that somebody would come help you if you needed it?
Yeah, the Forestry Commission here.
The Forestry Commission generally has the suppression authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they'd show up with some bulldozers.
We know some people that they've showed up. Well, you know some people. I'll tell you about it later.
Well, why don't you tell us right now? You don't have to say their name, but
as a former employee.
Yeah. And they had a fire get away and the Forestry Service had to show up.
In Chickasaw County.
Do they send you a bill when that happens?
I don't know. It didn't work here anymore. So
probably so.
Yeah, last year I had got a cell cam photo of a truck and a fire at my place. And a neighbor was trying to just burn his yard, and it got out, and it burned about 800 acres.
Yeah.
I really wasn't complaining. I was the areas that burned, I was
excited about.
Like, they weren't laid out, and I was kind of glad it happened, but –
Forestry consultants charge about, what, $30 an acre? What's the going rate these days?
About 20.
20. Yeah. You got it for free, Dudley.
Yeah. 20 to 30.
And I will share, like in Mississippi in particular, there are cost share programs too, Fire on the 40 and workshops.
Absolutely.
And kind of so check with your local resources.
It's $26 an acre is
what you can get right now.
Yeah.
So I got one quick question since we're talking about fire. Is there an ideal rotation for grasslands versus pines versus hardwoods? I mean, as far as in y'all's opinion, or just anytime you can or anytime you've got enough fuel to burn?
Yeah, I think that is a good question. And the answer, like always, is it depends on what your objectives are and where you're at. What the, you know, if you're in Mississippi on a high productivity site, you tend to be on the more frequent side to meet a lot of the objectives that folks listening to this probably care about. But you know, that can vary. I've worked on some sandhill sites, for example, really low productivity sites, and you know, you can get away with a 4, 5, 6 year interval in some situations for some objectives there. So if you start moving north, you know, the length of the fire return tends to increase as well, you know, where you might accomplish the same thing with a 4 to 6 year return interval that you would with a 2 to 4 in the south. So drier areas might be a little slower than wet.
Yeah, I would say that's also dependent on the amount of canopy coverage you have in an area. Mm-hmm. So the more open it is, probably the quicker the vegetation responds and gets past that ideal structure. So you got to burn it a little bit more often. Mm-hmm. Trying to think of other considerations as well. I mean, generally speaking, what we find in most of the turkey literature that shows selection for nesting and brood rearing in forested environments suggests that once things get about, you know, 3 years since fire or longer, you don't see a lot of turkey use of it.
Gotcha.
So on a, just, you know, keep in mind all the nuance that Marcus brought up just a second ago, but as a baseline, like most of the woodlands that I'm, you know, like when I work with landowners in the southeast, they're burning about every 2 years for turkeys. But one important thing to keep in mind with that too, though, is that turkeys use areas that aren't burned that frequently as well during other times of the year. You know, we focus a lot on, you know, turkey season, and we focus a lot on managing habitat for brood rearing during the summertime, but they have to make a living 12 months out of the year. Mm-hmm. And so you want to make sure that you have areas that are burned less frequently, and maybe even some that are not burned at all, that are providing for those other habitat components. And like especially in frequently burned areas, you know, one of the things that you're going to lose is a lot of your fruit production. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I was able to kind of like parlay that into this section, this segment of our conversation, because I think, you know, based off of the raccoon food habits literature that I went into, that's the primary factor that's limiting their use of uplands that are regularly burned, is it doesn't have much fruit production anymore.
That makes sense.
So, you think about your persimmons, your muscadines, your blueberries, your blackberries, you know, you're not going to have any of that really in areas that are burned every 2 years.
You may have them in on the edge of a little drain or something where the fire stops.
Right.
You know, like black cherry comes to mind. When it's young, it hates a fire, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But, so you know, one thing I was going to add to that is this is where being a gamekeeper comes into the mix, because there's all this nuance. It's hard for me to just give you a blanket recommendation. What it really comes down to is, what are you trying to accomplish? Do you want nesting cover or brooding cover? And then know what that looks like.
Exactly.
And then apply fire to create that vegetation structure. And if you know what it looks like that you're trying to accomplish, then you can get past that nuance by applying fire to create that structure. And when it's not in that structure, then you apply fire again
and burn it.
Yeah. Yeah. Fire is just a tool, just like, you know, a chainsaw or a sprayer or anything like that. We can mess habitat up just as quickly as we can enhance it if we don't know what we're doing. So by starting with that end state in mind, as far as plant species structure and species composition, you know, we can use those tools more effectively to try to end up where we want.
And one more, I got to ask, because I've been thinking about this the whole time listening to you. And this may be the most complex one, but I'm sure somebody, or you've had experience, people actually implementing or planting certain species, in whether it be post-fire, no-till drill, or certain species that like that their seed are stimulated by fire and propagating. You know, I did it one time. I tried some partridge pea before and after the fire and tried spreading it, and actually it did good spread before the fire. But I didn't know if you've had any experience with people taking, you know, native plants and, you know, preferred species and actually in and around the burning tried to establish stuff on their property that they didn't have there already that was preferred. And, you know, I'm sure it has to be taken in small bites, but have you had any experience with that? Because I am fascinated with trying it more. I've done a little.
Yeah. My experience with that, I've had some experience with various landowners that had gotten enrolled in a CP42, the pollinator practice.
Mm-hmm.
And they were buying native forb seeds, and, you know, it included partridge pea and a laundry list of other things. And they were planting them in fields. And then, you know, upon establishment, they were maintaining them with some combination of fire and disking. And I mean, frankly, some of those plots are managed really well or were exceptionally high quality brooding cover in terms of their structure and composition. Mm-hmm. One of the ones in North Mississippi that I have visited various times and helped the landowner get it established, she is really fascinated with birds just in general, and she wants there to be a lot of colorful birds around. And you want to talk about the avian community responding to those plantings that she did. And after the first one, and it got established well, seeing the impacts on the bird community led her to basically start establishing it all over the property. So she's now established several plots, and you know, the aesthetics of seeing all these American goldfinches and indigo bunnings and all these different colorful birds respond to that. She had tanagers, you know, that were showing up, all kinds of really cool birds that she was not accustomed to seeing, really inspired her to do that. And then meanwhile, I'm standing there looking at bugs jumping around everywhere thinking, man, this is excellent for a hen trying to brood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, I mean, that's the way agriculture was practiced before we had all the implements that we do today. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you clear some trees and burn off the area and plant it. And that's, you know, that's the way that it was done for hundreds of years.
We had dirty corn or dirty soybeans, which basically meant all the native forbs were in there competing with what you planted.
Right.
And that happened to be really good.
And fence rows.
Cover for a lot of these key wildlife species of interest.
Mm-hmm.
I did that, by the way. It's the first time I've actually gone in right behind a burn on some of this prairie dirt. and no-till drilled.
Yeah.
And we did just clover only. So, you know, we're not planting, you know, when we typically do in, say, October, maybe September. I'm going to be interested to see how it turns out.
Well, we know we did that this
fall. So you burned it.
This was like two or three weeks ago. Yeah. It was a grassy, clean field. I mean, I probably planted 15 acres worth with a no-till.
I'd really be interested to see how that clover does with that ash. You know,
let me tell you, we did some this fall. We burned grasslands this fall and then planted clover on top of it and didn't have much this winter. But right now there is clover everywhere. So,
Now I have had some experience with clover patches where we were burning it, you know, sort of, I guess, late summer, early fall, prepping it.
Right.
So crimson clover, it was reseeding itself. Mm-hmm. And that definitely worked real well.
So it didn't burn the seed up, you don't think?
Well, no, I mean, it did really well. It colonized and we had a good stand of clover multiple years in a row doing it.
Now, we went in right behind the fire.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty quick. Yeah.
Pretty quick after
But that. Yeah, with
but
the-
I think one thing that you could really come to with that type of approach is that especially in the fall, that burning at that time stimulates a lot of our good forb plants. Mm-hmm. And if you have established clover, you can have a really great patch of clover through deer season, turkey season, you know, really high use of it. And then a lot of the forbs that colonize those natives can produce a really high quality structure with that clover for brooding. So it could be a really good way to manage those fields, to kind of balance those different, different objectives.
Man, I've seen it. Not the older I get, the bigger fan I am of clovers. I'm just
loving them. Works out.
I absolutely love
out there working for you.
So do you guys have a lot of alumni or something that say, "Hey, Will, why don't you come down here and we'll go turkey hunting and you can tell me about what I need to burn."
Here he goes.
Do y'all get a lot of those opportunities?
Well, gosh, are either of you work at the school that Bobby's an alumni? Let me think about it.
No, I'm just asking, do they get opportunities to go on some like is Dan Moultrie, Will, is Dan Moultrie ever taken you to his place and showed you around?
No, I hadn't been out to his place. But yes, that does occur.
Hey, Will, Bobby has a place now. Do you feel a hook, like a treble hook in the corner of your mouth? No,
I'm actually wanting to go with Will.
He's trying to go with him.
He's setting you up.
Them.
He's setting you up for something. No, trust me.
Yeah, a hunt. That's what he's digging at, of course.
I'd love it if there were far more opportunities, but it happens from time to time.
Yeah, that's true.
I'll tell you what's been very, very lucrative too is staying in touch with some of these former students that end up managing fantastic properties.
Ah, so, there you go. Yeah, they got all the keys. That's right.
That's right.
Now we smoked him out, Bobby.
Yeah, we did. You know, and Marcus appreciate this. Our friend Bronson, I think he did exactly that and got to go to Texas this year and killed a really big deer over in Texas.
Did. Good for him.
Yeah, that was a good looking deer.
Yeah.
Well deserved.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So look, we've been up here talking for a while. These guys got a lot to do, but we probably ought to wrap this up. We ought to ask them their trivia question real quick.
You should know if you bring up fire, we're going to go overtime if we're talking about fires.
For sure. So Richie, why don't you tee up the Sheffield? And Dudley, I appreciate you. I like your hat.
My Sheffield Financial hat. Yeah, I love it.
Today's trivia is brought to you by Sheffield Financial. Fuel your GameKeeper projects with financing for power sports, outdoor power equipment, and trailers. Begin your next conservation adventure at SheffieldFinancial.com.
All right, well, so we've got two questions.
What's the prize this week?
Let's go, Matt.
So the prize this week is number 4 GameKeeper turkey vest. And y'all are playing for Cade 0506, who left us a review, and we've got two pretty layup questions.
We've only got one more vest.
I gave us five.
I say it's a layup because I got them right. So if I can get them right, y'all say I can get these right.
Pressure's on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And look, if you're not Cade 0506. You can go to the GameKeeper Fieldwear. They've given us a code. It's podcast25 and get 25% off of the GameKeeper Fieldwear.
Nice.
And that vest.
All right, so what we're going to do, since we've got both of y'all, if you could write your answer down and show it. So we'll test you both.
It's like Jeopardy.
Oh, that's a convenient excuse.
Yeah. All right. So the first question is, we'll give everybody some time to get their number two pencils out.
Number two. I'm going to write it on my phone on the notes.
In the Google Google section of Safari.
Look, if y'all don't get this first one right, you may lose your tenure.
Come on, Bobby. Y'all lay off these guys.
And the quickness of the response, I mean, that also gets a hat nod as well. So
we're not supposed to blurt it out.
Though. Don't blurt it out. Just write it down. Got how it. Many turkey feathers are in a tail fan?
Typically.
Oh, that's
typically. That's true.
That's the kind that's easy for the smart guys to forget. They're both having to think about it.
Nah.
Well, that's something for everybody to do is count them now, too, after this.
Laney, you got an answer?
Me?
I got it.
Yeah.
I'm writing my guess now. That's what it is.
I got that one all day and twice on Sunday. And if you don't believe us, go start counting them. They are exceptions.
There are exceptions, yeah.
But it's a high percentage.
And it's not when you
shoot
them.
You got yours, Marcus?
Yeah, I've written it down.
All right.
Let's see them.
I can't read that.
I can't read either one of them. They're both right.
Just say it.
16.
16.
What does Marcus say?
16.
I got 18.
I'm 18.
Eight,
yeah.
18.
Start counting them.
Wow.
Well, they're consistent, though. They both.
I bet I've counted hundreds.
Yeah, every one I've got.
And I've, occasionally there's a 20. I'm barely a 19.
Yeah.
But almost all of them are
18. That's interesting.
So we're finding it to be 18, guys.
So you're telling us y'all typically will shoot a tail feather or two out. Which tells me.
They're missing those two middles.
Marcus will shoot them in strut. Now we know.
So we'll give you a chance to redeem yourself with this next question.
Oh, man.
We're not professors. We're professors. We're not paid to have common sense.
Yeah.
All right, this one's more.
Well, counted a fan once, and I was almost certain it was 16.
You must have blown those two middle ones out of there.
That's probably what happened.
But, no, you know, by the way, it's funny. Laney, when he first asked him about years ago, he said four. Four. Because he's chased many down.
Yeah, I do.
I think what it is.
Grabbed by the tail feather.
I think what it is I don't count the outer ones on Jake's.
That's what it was. We knew it was something.
Hey,
have a turkey right behind you, Will. You could have just run around.
Well, they would have seen me.
Right. He's going to go, as soon as we're off air, he's going to go count them.
I don't know what's happening.
I love how they can learn some obscure percentage, you know, of a population from a study in 1968. But
well, look, I didn't.
It's all of that that makes them forget the tail feather number. So I'm taking up for y'all on that.
Well, I thought I remembered it being 16 and because I had counted it and I just misremembered.
I was really confident in that number too.
Yeah, I was too.
Richie wanted us to ask how many toes, and I said, no, they'll get that. I know they'll get that. Go ahead, Matt.
Depends on if it's Will or not, because he shoots the toes off of them sometimes.
Hey, yeah, but shooting my ass, a tough one. When they got lead shot in their feet.
I mean, when you're in a tree stand, the angle.
No, I was thinking of something else, but I won't say it.
Another angle.
Yep. Go ahead, Matt.
I think I've already proven to you guys I am horrible with trivia.
Well, this one.
Well, that makes it fun for Bobby. So go ahead, Mike.
All right, this one, Mike. We'll go with a free throw on this one. So the bonus question is, what is the most biodiverse river system in the United States?
That's not exactly a free throw.
I wouldn't say it's a free throw.
I would think it'd have to be the longest one.
Well,
you know, to cover more territory.
No, not necessarily.
You wouldn't think so.
It's going to surprise you.
Is this really?
Mac, you got this question right.
Yeah, I thought it was. Yeah,
so we've mentioned this on here before. They're more just in this river system than any other in the United States.
There's I think y'all have been cruel.
Snails, crawfish, turtles,
mussels,
fish.
Bobby, did you know it before?
Yes.
You already knew this before.
And they both should. Both these guys should know this.
Because, Is that because of where we're from?
Well,
I've already written my answer.
I've got it down. I've written mine too. I had it down to two.
All right, let's see.
Yep.
What do you got, Will?
I wrote that. Tom Bigby.
Tom Bigby.
Well, he's partially right there.
That is.
What do we got with? Did Marcus write?
Well, I was thinking of Tom Bigby and Alabama River.
That's where I was too. I wasn't sure which one it was.
Those are both correct.
Yeah.
So I'll read this. So the Alabama River system is the most biologically diverse freshwater system in North America and is one of the most biodiverse anywhere in the world. Thanks to its dizzying diversity of mussels, snails, fish, turtles, crawfish, and panthers.
Oh, yeah. That's what did it. The one species that threw it over the top.
I just thought it was pretty interesting that Alabama's got that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I would have naturally thought, just the biggest river system. But
well, someday they're going to have you on their podcast, Bobby, and they're going to be relentlessly
Hey, we got that one right.
You did.
Yeah, that's right.
Close enough.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. I thought I remembered that it was the Alabama River because I remembered how many species – like of conservation concern were associated with it. And it's just,
you think about the
astonishing number,
the differences of soil and habitat. Yeah. They both cut through the Black Prairie from and on into the coastal plains from there. And it goes through so many different.
Yeah. And you got the Black Warrior, that biodiversity myself.
Alabama.
Tom Bigby.
Yeah. Tom Bigby.
You know, we need to send the two good docs a t-shirt.
I was thinking the same thing, Matt. We got a new podcast t-shirt. We need to get them hooked up.
We got some other ones, too. We got some really cool new Mossick Properties t-shirts.
Yeah. Do y'all like tank tops? We'll get you a couple.
Will does.
We call that one the Dudley.
The Dud.
Yeah, we'll do that. We appreciate y'all being on. It's always fun to talk to y'all. We're big fans of what y'all are doing.
And yeah, 100%.
Certainly appreciative.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, I'm sure Marcus will love wearing those tank tops with his jorts, now that he's down at UF.
So, Will, tell everybody how they can listen to y'all's podcast.
Wild Turkey Science. It's on Spotify, Apple, pretty much anywhere you consume your podcast.
YouTube. Anywhere
good stuff.
Good stuff.
Tune in.
Well, we're cheering y'all on. Keep it up.
The dynamic duo. Batman. Who's Batman and who's Robin? I never figured that out.
We'll let y'all decide.
I don't know, Marcus. You look like a Batman to me.
There you go.
You got the more ominous beard of the two.
Is that a transmitter on the turkey behind you?
It is. Ah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a transmitter that we actually put out on a bird.
Cool.
Yeah, it looks like you got him.
Yeah.
Got him. Careful, Marcus is telling on you.
No.
Were you able to like...
Will goes ahead and tracks them, and then see the outcome.
Yeah, you knew where he was roosted,
have to put me in a padded
room. He knew exactly where he was roosted.
Some people say roosted's not roasted. I say tag's not bagged.
That's good.
Man.
Yeah, I was just... Bobby has been so fascinated with that concept the whole time, and the psychologist will teach you that man in the mirror syndrome. People are so sure you would do what they would do in your position. So Bobby's so fascinated with that tracking one during turkey season thing. I don't know if he'd succumb to that or not, Bobby.
I don't know.
You seem infatuated by it.
Well, I never noticed it on that. I've been looking at his turkey the whole time we were talking. I never noticed that wire.
Yeah.
Good. So the turkey was actually given. It was gifted to me. It was independent of the transmitter, and we just put the transmitter on it for fun afterwards.
All right, guys, we enjoyed it, and
thank y'all
for
being here.
Yeah, hopefully we get to break day with y'all one day soon.
You never know, but think about what y'all started on this trek, and even obviously your careers before. And I said it is a small silk properties crowd. We just had them in. When you get to make a difference, and this is me being serious, I always do it, get serious, but seriously, when you make a difference in what you love in your life, what a gift that is. Because, a lot of people don't get to do that.
Absolutely.
And so y'all definitely are doing that. And for that, thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
It's our pleasure.
Kind of like soldiers and law enforcement. It's like, when I see y'all, I want to say thank you for your service,
Yeah.
Because it's important.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
All right.
Thanks for the support, guys.
Well, you look good. You look fit, and that shirt fits you well.
He's working you for something, Will. I don't know.
Get ready.
Yeah, something's coming.
He's going to ask something.
All right, y'all be good. Looking around the room, everybody's, we got a busy day. Why don't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley.
Get us out of here, Richie.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife magazine. And don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.